Capitola, California, with Robert Anton Wilson, who has graciously consented to give us an interview for Enlightenment.com. Let me start with Prometheus Rising, which I have to say was the book of yours that I imprinted most deeply back when I was 23 or so. And in that book, you speak of enlightenment being equivalent to brain change, and you state that when the accumulated facts, gimmicks, tools, techniques, and gadgets of neuroscience, the science of brain change and brain liberation, reaches a certain critical mass, we will all be able to free ourselves from these robot cycles. We've been approaching that critical mass for several decades now, and we'll reach the crossover point in less than 10 years. That was about 20 years ago, so this is an unfair question, but do you still feel we're heading towards something like that?
Yeah, I remain an incorrigible optimist. A lot of my predictions have failed because I made them a little too specific. I have learned the great wisdom of Robert Heinlein, who said it does not pay a prophet to be too specific. However, some flowers just grew out of the head of a statue of Kuan Yin in Korea yesterday, and is being accepted as a miracle by Buddhists all over Korea who are flocking to a site. They say it indicates a new Buddha is about to arrive. So I'm not the only incorrigible optimist around.
No, you're not. And you've actually helped a lot of people learn how to be more optimistic and get more into their own ability to change their brain and liberate themselves.
Well, the way I look at it, the pessimists lead dreary lives. As a matter of fact, they're not only uncomfortable most of the time, they try to make everybody else uncomfortable. And I can't cite the source, but I have it somewhere in my computer. There was a study that showed optimists outlive pessimists by 19%. Now, why the hell does anybody want to be a pessimist when that means it's going to shorten their lives? It's a gloomy philosophy, and it makes for miserable, short lives. I prefer to be optimistic and cheerful and stay high.
And when you say stay high, you're talking about everything from just positive self-talk and self-hypnosis to doing actual practices to what you eat, or what do you mean?
Everything. I have tried virtually every consciousness-altering technique to some extent. The one I like least was the Lilly isolation tank. Mm-hmm. I got quite bored, and then I started getting paranoid.
Did you do that? I got bored again. Or did you do that with?
No, I was straight, and I decided there must be something in it. So many people get so much out of it, but it's not my shtick. You got to find what's good for you, not what works for other people. The isolation tank didn't do a damn thing for me except make me bored and mildly paranoid. Well, I got paranoid about how to get paranoid about something to stave off the boredom. I got paranoid about the thought the whole house might be on fire and I'm down here and I don't know it. This was in a friend's house who had an isolation tank. Of course, that mechanism whereby you substitute fear for boredom, that's one of the most common traps people fall into. They'd rather have any emotion than boredom. And it's easier to think of miserable things than happy things, especially when you're floating in the dark and you can't, oh well, I don't like isolation tanks. I'm not against anybody who gets anything good out of them. Hooray for them. I cheer them on. It's just not my shtick.
Mm-hmm. So you said you've tried pretty much every possible practice and technique that you could find over the course of your life. What stuck out in your mind as working really well for you?
Well, I'm not going to put them in order from 1 to 10 of the, because it's hard to say. They interact synergetically. They all help one another. General semantics, neuro-linguistic programming, marijuana, LSD, Zen meditation, transcendental meditation, Kabbalistic magic, brain tuning machines, Hatha yoga, which I don't do anymore. Mm-hmm. And a few others I can't quite remember right now. I've tried just about everything I can think of.
And when someone is kind of new to this world of trying these sorts of things, how would you recommend they go about figuring out what works for them?
I would say they should start with something really down to earth and not too weird. I would tell them, don't start with occult practices. Don't start with Western magic or invoking angels or anything like that. Start with something like general semantics or neuro-linguistic programming and work your way out gradually to the wilder shores of consciousness. But people plunge into, the Golden Dawn system or the Thelemic system, quite often they go quite nuts. They're not ready to deal with the kind of energies and seeming entities that you contact with those methods.
Seeming entities? Are the entities real?
I haven't made up my mind yet.
Really?
Well, it's like T.S. Eliot, famous story about T.S. Eliot. He was on a ship coming back from France to England. And as they approached the white cliffs of Dover, somebody said, they're so beautiful, it's hard to believe they're real. And Eliot said, oh, they're real enough. And a literary critic named Hugh Kenner pointed out, because Eliot said it, we can read it about five different ways, because we're so used to ambiguity in his poetry, we attribute it to his ordinary speech. They're real enough compared to us? Were they real enough? Were they real enough? How real do you have to be really real? And that's the way I feel about the entities that you contact through Kabbalistic magic. They're real enough. They're not quite as real as the IRS. Mm-hmm. They're easier to get rid of than the IRS, for instance.
So I've often thought that if I personally were to get interested in, let's say, UFOs and the whole alien world and hang out with some friends on a mountain, and that undoubtedly I would meet real aliens eventually, and I would know that they were real.
Well, they'd be real for you anyway.
So is it true that whatever reality tunnel you choose to go down does become more real for you?
Well, yeah, by definition. What you consider important and real is important and real to you. It may be totally unimportant and unreal to somebody else, but it's important and real to you.
So,
who is the master? You know, there's a riddle. Who is the master who makes the grass green? Who puts the pessimists in a pessimistic world? Who puts the angry people in an angry world? Who puts the happy people in a happy world? Who does make the grass green? Is that too obscure?
No. But I'm just wondering more about real. Like, take, for example, parapsychology. The last book that I read was Dean Radin's The Conscious Universe, and he goes through the latest proofs, and it seems pretty unambiguous that any trained scientific mind looking at meta-analysis and all of the proofs that have been done would have to admit something is going on here. There is an actual phenomena that we can measure. And yet, when people don't want to believe that, they still claim that all sorts of psychic phenomena are completely bogus, even though it seems objectively true to me now that they are real.
Well, that's one of the more controversial areas, but that goes on all over the shop in science. Take AIDS, for instance. 97% of the public believes AIDS is caused by the HIV virus. The 3% of dissenters are mostly leading scientists who had good reputations before they started to dissent on that particular issue. And you got to become a molecular biologist in order to carry on an intelligent conversation between the opposing factions there. So all you can do in most cases is make a guess. As for parapsychology, I think the evidence is good enough that something is going on. I tend to connect it with quantum mechanics and Bell's theorem and the basic interconnectedness of all parts of the universe. As a matter of fact, I think the best model of the universe isn't in science at all. It's in Finnegan's Wake. Everything in Finnegan's Wake is connected with everything else, which is sort of the way I see the world operating.
So sort of holographically interpenetrated, or?
That's right. I call Finnegan's Wake hologramic prose. And I think we're living in a hologramic universe.
Which brings us to the whole physics and mysticism movement that's been going on for 30 or 40 years now.
Even longer than that, back in the 1930s when the Swedish court knighted Niels Bohr, he took the yin-yang symbol of the Chinese for his coat of arms.
So before the Dancing Woolly Masters and those sorts of books in the 60s, people were working about trying to connect physics and mysticism even back then?
Well, Schrödinger wrote What Is Life in around the late 1940s, or the early 1940s. Anyway, he wrote it in the 1940s. And he comes to the conclusion in that book that there's only one mind in the whole universe, and it's an optical illusion that makes us think we have separate minds. Mm-hmm. That sounds like Eastern mysticism, doesn't it? He comes to that conclusion by trying to understand what quantum physics really means.
Well, and Einstein said we have to escape from the three illusions of time, personality, and space.
He said, did he say that?
Yeah, he did. And in fact, there's a very interesting book by Ken Wilber called Quantum Questions, I think, where he goes through almost all of the great physicists, and they all had mystical leanings. But because Wilber is anti-mystical in a certain sense, he ends up trying to show that they were mystical despite, not because, the fact that they were physicists. Eventually, they were so overwhelmed with that they had discovered that they got thrown into mysticism from it.
What was that, space, time, and personality?
Space, time, and personality.
When I first met Timothy Leary, one of the first things I remember him saying was, the value of acid is at the peak. The space game comes to an end. The time game comes to an end. And even the Timothy Leary game comes to an end.
Which it has.
Well, yeah, but he was well prepared for it. He was used to dying.
Let me ask you a question about Tim Leary. I've often thought that perhaps one of your most important contributions was the clarity with which you expounded Tim Leary's eight-circuit model. Obviously, you did a great job at that.
Thank you.
What was it like for you, kind of knowing Tim and working with that and putting that out?
Well, the biggest thrill I ever got as far as that's concerned is when Tim told me, you describe my ideas more clearly than I can myself.
Right.
I think that's the highest praise you can get from a genius, and I did consider Tim a genius.
Do you still feel his, in Prometheus Bound, you talk about the fact that it's the most complete map of reality in the universe that you had discovered up until that point, but that you expect it would be supplanted in 15 or 20 years. Is it still the best map you've seen?
Yeah, I assume it must have been supplanted, but I can't keep up with everything. I can't find, when you get to be my age, pardon me for sounding like Foxy Grandpa, but when you get to be my age, you realize if you set out to be a generalist 40 years ago, every specialized area that you know something about, your knowledge is somewhere between 5 and 20 years behind the latest that's been published in that field. And I'm not just talking about science. One of my passions is James Joyce, who's already entered this conversation a couple of times. I can't keep up with Joyce scholarship. And how can I keep up with everything else I'm interested in? I wrote an article about Bell's theorem about a year ago. I went hunting on the web. I found new criticisms of Bell that I hadn't heard of before. If I hadn't looked on the web, I would have ignored them entirely.
But you don't regret having been a generalist. I mean, that's why you.
I don't regret it, but I feel more and more tentative about everything. I feel everything I know is either 5 to 20 years out of date. Well, except for a few things, like what I had for breakfast.
What did you have for breakfast?
Shredded wheat.
Was it good?
Yeah.
Good. Going back to magic for a bit, do you think that magic is real the way, let's say, there's that word real and the word is, both of which are not invited here, but nonetheless, do you think magic is real the same way that someone like Aleister Crowley thought it was real? I mean, can the mind actually produce, not only changes in conformity with its will, but effects at a distance in space and time?
Well, let's put it this way. When you manipulate the archetypes of the collective unconscious, synchronicities are often activated. Did I use the word activate twice in that sentence? Yeah, bad style. When you activate the archetypes of the collective unconscious, you often produce synchronicities or side effects. Does that answer your question?
Well, you're saying that you're not willing to put any kind of causal bounds on it, but there does seem to be more interaction between impacted parts that you're interested in.
Yeah, let me try to get my head clear on this subject. I use Christian Science quite a bit. I'm probably the only agnostic Christian scientist in the world. I have observed that Christian scientists all die eventually. Even Mary Baker Eddy herself died. And yet Christian Science does work. It works more often than it fails. Well, they'd all be in jail. You know, every now and then a Christian Scientist gets arrested for using prayer instead of medicine.
Or for not letting their kid go to the hospital.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Well, if it failed as frequently as materialists, fundamentalist materialists would expect it to fail, they'd all be in jail. It works most of the time, but it doesn't work all the time. And you can't predict when it's going to work. To make it work, you got to build up an enthusiastic simulation of faith, if you can't actually produce faith. And that helps it to work. But of course, you shouldn't be a damn fool about it. Personally, I do not boycott doctors. I feel Christian Science is an aid and adjunct to any other type of therapy I may be using. Like right now, I am rather incapacitated, partially incapacitated by post-polio syndrome. I am being treated by a physician who's using mostly nutritional methods to treat the condition, which seem to work better than orthodox allopathic medicine, but I'm supplementing that with a great deal of Christian Science, which he knows about and doesn't object to.
In Prometheus Rising, you talk about, again, basically getting your brain to work so that in the fifth circuit, your body can heal what it needs to heal. I mean, you imply there that something like real direct magic going far beyond what normal science understands is possible, and that the great potential of the human being lies in getting our neurology to work the way it might begin to work.
Yeah, well, I think that by and large, my agnostic form of Christian Science has worked well enough that in spite of what have I got? I've got post-polio syndrome, which is a mechanical problem. Part of my muscles are dead, and the muscles that have been working to overtime for 64 years, ever since I had polio to keep me walking around, they just got exhausted from overwork. But I've never been in a hospital in my adult life. I've never had any surgery. I don't have any of the major fatal diseases. I expect I'm going to die. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure of it. But I don't know when or of what. But I'm doing damn well health-wise. And I think basic Christian Science principles are working. I could call it religious science because I'm a little closer to them, actually. They don't ban the use of medicine. They say you can supplement it with what they call prayer. I call it positive thinking or positive affirmations.
When I read Prometheus Rising, I still have my copy in my pack over there, I noticed that I wrote a few times, no mention of Seth. You know, Seth and Jane Roberts and the whole notion that you co-create reality and you create your own reality, that seems a bit even more far out and outlandish than most other things. And I was curious if you had read that stuff or had thought about it, or the whole channeled entity, you are co-creating your reality sort of thing.
Well, you do co-create your reality. You don't, to paraphrase Karl Marx, you don't co-create it out of nothing.
So we're all somehow co-creating being here together.
Yeah, well, the way I look at it, you get hit by a car. I don't believe that anybody can prove what some New Agers claim, which is that you needed to be hit by the car, or you wanted to be hit by the car, or there's some karmic reason why you got hit by the car. But I do think in the hospital, presuming you weren't killed immediately, how fast you recover does depend a great deal on your attitude. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, there's dozens of medical studies that tend to confirm this. They're not well known, and the AMA hates to talk about them, but there are plenty of studies. And a very good book on this subject, which doesn't use any metaphysical language at all, puts it all in scientific language, is the Psychobiology of Mind-Body Healing by Ernest Lawrence Rossi, who's a very successful Ericksonian hypnotist. Mm-hmm. And he explains in microscopic detail how the things going on in your frontal lobes affect the back parts of the brain, which through the nervous system affect every other part of the body, including the immunological system.
And all standard science wants to do is say there's a placebo effect that we don't understand. We'll just call it a placebo effect, and that explains it all.
Yeah, that really drives me up the wall. It's the placebo. What the hell does that mean? I want to know in concrete, you know, how it works. And that's what I liked about Rossi's book and a lot of other studies along those lines. And neuro-linguistic programming, I think, has a great deal of how it works.
I've heard you talk a couple of times already here about attitude and cultivating a sort of a positive frame of mind with respect to the sorts of subjects that you've been interested in talking about. It seems to me that in the 60s, something happened. There was some kind of transmission of a positive attitude, and a lot of people were getting turned on to a whole possible spectrum of brain change technologies. And now it kind of seems that that whole thing has gone underground or sort of died down or isn't nearly as up as it used to be.
Oh, I'm not at all sure about that. You can't. What's underground? What's underground is what the corporate media decides to ignore. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist just because they're not covering it.
So do you think there are millions
look at
of people?
Look at how many protesters there were on Inauguration Day, and the corporate media completely blocked them out. Just because they're not paying attention to it doesn't mean it's gone underground or it's moribund or something like that. Of course, you can't judge by ear. If I judge the world by the people I know who live in Santa Cruz County and the people I meet on when I go and give a lecture or a workshop, I would assume that the whole world is made up entirely of neurological magicians and sorcerers of the mind and so on, and optimists and internet literate people and so on. Whereas, from what I gather from the mass media, most of the country still thinks the Earth is flat, and in Kansas you can't even teach that we have relatives swinging through the trees in Africa and Asia and so on.
The web. You like the web? Do you use it much?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, the book I'm currently writing, I have done virtually all my research on the web. I find almost everything I want to look up I can find on the web. The web grows faster every week.
And do you think there are, I told you a little bit about what enlightenment.com is trying to do, and there's many other groups that are trying to somehow spread knowledge of what works and create more neurological magicians. Do you think web can be effective in something like this, or how would you like to see it go?
Oh, yeah. Well, the web gets all sorts of information around that's doesn't get around much in the, I hate to use the cliche, the corporate media, but what else can you call them? The major media, the monopolized media, the media of Rupert Murdoch and a few others, that media doesn't care to deal with a lot of subjects. And the internet, that, well, to me, the most exciting thing about internet isn't any one particular potential, but the unlimited potentials. It's the first media that really belongs to its users. There's no gatekeeper. I don't know who coined that term, the gatekeeper, but when books appeared, right away they were gatekeepers, the Holy Inquisition, the censorship boards of various governments and so on. And movies had the gatekeepers. They still have gatekeepers. They still can't go too far or the whole house collapses on them. Television has gatekeepers. Every media has gatekeepers to decide what can be broadcast through that media and what can't. Internet, there are no gatekeepers. Every attempt to create gatekeepers has failed because it'll screw up the whole economy. So much of modern business depends on internet that they can't start putting roadblocks up, because if they do, the whole economy will collapse. So they got to let it run its well, run free. And as long as it runs free, that means every damned opinion that's blackened out, blocked out, excised, censored, removed from the corporate media is now, you can find it on internet. That's everything from the ravings of the crazy anti-Semites to the most far out scientific thinking that's too far out to get into the recognized scientific journals. I mean, it's a spectrum from lunacy to genius. But there's no gatekeeper. You got to figure out for yourself which is the lunacy and which is the genius, which I think is very good too. That's forcing people to learn to use their intelligence a little more and to be a little more critical in their thinking.
But if there is a signal about brain change science and one were to attempt to put it on the internet, how would you prevent it from then getting just drowned in the noise of everything else that's on the internet?
Well, information and noise, that's a very interesting question. The information tends to be found by the people who need it. They keep looking until they do find it. The noise, well, the noise is the price we pay for freedom. I remember I was living in Chicago at the time the Nazis wanted to make their march into Skokie, which was full of Holocaust survivors. And people were dropping out of the ACLU in hundreds and thousands, maybe. They were so pissed off that the ACLU defended the rights of the Nazis to march. I don't like Nazis. I don't like Nazis marching into places where Holocaust survivors live. But I felt the ACLU was absolutely right. Anytime anybody's freedom is taken away, that's a little bit of my freedom is disappearing down the drain too, because once they got a precedent, they can apply it to anybody. So I stuck with the ACLU all through that.
Can I ask you a little bit about conspiracies?
Sure, if that has anything to do with enlightenment.
Well, I'm just kind of curious. So there were three questions I wanted to just quickly ask you about that, and you can deny to answer them. The first one is the obvious one, and I just, for my own archetypal reasons, want to ask you directly, who did kill John F. Kennedy?
In my opinion, I don't know, but in my opinion, I think the strongest evidence points to James Jesus Angleton of the CIA and to Sam Giancana of the Mafia, and I don't know which was the dog and which was the tail, but those are the two leading suspects as far as I'm concerned. I don't claim either of them. Well, they're both dead. They can't even be put on trial now, can they? So they can't offer a defense. But they look like the most likely suspects to me.
Do you think there are people alive who know the answer?
Probably. But let me add, I'm very skeptical about Kennedy conspiracy theories because most of them don't know enough about self-criticism to criticize their own. Most of the Kennedy conspiracy buffs have their own pet theory, and they think everybody with another theory must be a CIA disinformation agent sent out to confuse the sincere researchers. Now, once you start thinking that way, that everybody who disagrees with you is part of the enemy sent to confuse you, you never learn anything again after that because your mind has stopped working. I try to give them all a fair hearing, but I'm pretty skeptical about them when they start complaining or yelling that they got the answer. They know just who did it. It was definitely Sam Giancana. Or who's the other? Oh, there's a couple of other mafia. Oh, Johnny Rosselli, you know. Or there was the long what's the word I'm looking
Regular.
for? Entanglement of the CIA and the mafia goes back to World War II, even before the CIA existed, when it was called the OSS. They've been in bed together for so long that they've brought forth some truly incredible progeny.
Okay, second question. Do you think there was some sort of military cover-up of physical evidence of extraterrestrials?
Maybe.
In your opinion?
In my opinion, the evidence isn't good enough for me to decide. I also think the world would be a hell of a lot better off if everybody used the word maybe more often. Can you imagine if Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, I don't want to control speech, but this is a Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. If the furthest they could go is maybe Jesus was the Son of God, and if the furthest the Muslims could go is maybe Allah is the only God and maybe Muhammad is his prophet, and the farthest out the Marxist could go is maybe we understand history better than you, and the furthest psychop could go is maybe the research we don't like is seriously flawed. People are too damn sure of themselves without enough evidence in most cases, and I think that's really one of the most appalling things about the present condition of humanity.
Does that happen in ordinary interpersonal interactions between people? People making assumptions about other people and what they do and why they do it?
All the time, yeah.
Okay, third conspiracy question. Do you think maybe it's more probable and more likely than not that something in this last election was that there was a conspiracy of some sort with getting George Bush elected?
I have to go back on my maybe principles. That one to me, well, instead of, you know, maybe was sort of a verbal equivalent of John von Neumann's mathematics, in which between 1 and 0 you had a 1/2 value, which represented maybe. Kozybski suggested we could generalize that and put it in terms of probabilities, like from 10%, from 0% to 100%. I would say the evidence that the election was rigged is about 90% proven to my satisfaction. But getting back to the UFOs, I think maybe aliens have been found by the military wreckage. And then again, maybe the military is letting that story leak deliberately to cover up things they don't want us to know about. As long as people are running around yelling about UFOs, they're not complaining about radiation experiments the government might be conducting on us, for instance. The last one who spoke about that was Hazel O'Leary, and she had to resign a couple of months later, didn't she? Mm-hmm. We don't know what the hell the government is doing most of the time.
What about free energy research, that sort of thing? You know, follow-ups to Tesla or Wilhelm Reich, all that. I mean, it always seems interesting and exciting, and the people I know who ever worked on that stuff always seem to have their laboratories broken in on and destroyed just where they're on the verge of really proving something or taking it out to the public.
Oh, it's not just that. Besides Reich and Tesla, look at solar power. Solar power, or the people who are hiking our energy bills up every month keep telling us, well, solar power is about 40 years in the future. They've been saying that for about 40 years now. Actually, I not only know people who have largely solar-powered houses. Carl Hess did in West Virginia. So does the district attorney of Santa Barbara. I met him once. There's a suburb of Dallas in which the whole damn suburb is 85% solar-powered. No, I think there's definitely conspiratorial or at least greed-oriented forces at work in our society to keep us from doing things the technologically best, ecologically cleanest, and economically most beneficial way, because they're making profits out of doing it the dirty old way, and they don't want to cut down on their profits.
That's not part of what you called capitalistic magic earlier, is it?
No, I was talking about Kabbalistic magic.
Oh,
not
Kabbalistic.
Oh,
great.
I wasn't talking about... Oh, capital,
well, that explains a lot.
Capitalist magic, you see, is when you take a piece of paper and you print something on it and you wave a magic wand over it and you say it's money, and then you make people pay you interest for giving it to them. That's the way the Federal Reserve operates. We know it's magic because other people can print exactly the same types of designs on paper, and it's not money because they don't have the magic wand that the Federal Reserve has. They're counterfeiters. The Federal Reserve is not counterfeiters because they have a magic wand and they turn paper into money.
Right.
That's capitalist magic. Well, that's nothing to do with capitalistic magic.
Is the same thing true of spiritual teachers, those who are believed in to be powerful enough to affect enlightenment and transformation in people? They say things, they wave their hands, they have people do exercises, and people experience themselves waking up or being enlightened. And they were to do the same exercises by themselves, they might not, because they don't believe in themselves the way they do in the teacher.
Yeah, I can see a certain value in the Oriental guru system, but by and large, I don't think it works very well for Occidentals, because...
A point Carl Jung made.
Yeah, we just do not have enough... We don't have the tradition out of which we can trust somebody that totally to let them take that command over us. And the people who do have that kind of faith are generally idiots, and they end up in things like People's Temple or Scientology or the Branch Davidians. No, I have no enlightened master guiding me, and if I met one, I'd kill him, to quote a Zen proverb.
So you don't think that there are sort of...
I wouldn't eat them, though. I don't admire Hannibal Lecter that much.
So you don't believe there are truly pure people on this planet of such spiritual power that were you to meet one of them, you would know that this was a truly holy, God-realized individual and be overwhelmed with feelings of
Yeah, but I get that from books and movies and music and all sorts of places. I have great reverence for Beethoven, for instance.
So
but I don't think Beethoven is going to tell me what to eat for dinner tonight. Or
then it's kind of a cult of personality thing, with people find a teacher or a master and they elevate them to the level of God.
Well, I think a perfect master is an absolutely ideal functionary if you want to be a perfect slave. But my ambition is not to be a perfect slave, so I don't want a perfect master.
And this gets back to your notion that in the West, the idea has always been to unleash all of our human potential. You know, we had it in the Renaissance, we had it in the Greeks, and perhaps we'll have it now as well.
That seems to be the general direction of Western mysticism, too. Eastern, of course, everything is subject to qualification and modification, but largely Eastern mysticism stresses submission, like Islam means submission, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. Western mysticism tends to emphasize self-actualization. Western mysticism is more closely allied with the left wing and Eastern mysticism with the right wing, more or less. These are overgeneralizations, but I'm just talking about general flavors rather than absolutes.
What do you think of attempts to integrate Eastern mysticism and Western?
I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think both sides can learn a lot from the other.
What do you think your most important contributions have been in the long run? What are you most proud of?
Good God. That's a hell of a question. I don't know. To quote T.S. Eliot again, why am I on a T.S. Eliot vibe today? I seldom quote him, but here I go again. That is not our concern. That's what he said when they asked him, who's the most important poet? Do you think you're the most important poet of the 20th century, or is it Yeats or Pound or who? That is not our concern. You can't judge your own work. I never try to judge my own work, because if I go too far in one direction, it leads to egomania, megalomania, or some other inflammation of the ego. If I go too far in the other direction, it leads to despair and giving up writing entirely. And how do I find the middle path? I prefer not to think about it at all and just hope that my work has some value for some people. I know it has some value for some people, yeah. The question is how many and for how long. Ah, thank you.
Yeah, I think your work's been very valuable. What are you working on now?
A book called The Tale of the Tribe, which is about Ezra Pound, James Joyce, and Internet. That's a very, very, very terse description of it. It deals with a lot more than that. Those are the three main topics.
And what are you doing that's new and fun for you in your life at this point?
Oh, what am I doing that's new and fun? Exploring the web. I'm still traveling and doing lectures and workshops, which is a real delight. This is getting rather personal, but ever since my leg problems got so serious last year, it's been a real delight to me to find out that I can still travel and do lectures. I would hate to be just sitting at the computer writing all the time. It does me a great deal of good to get out and meet people. I enjoy that very much. And I got a group that meets once a week. We're reading Finnegan's Wake together and discussing it.
Out loud, I take it.
Yeah, of course. That's the only way to... William York Tyndall discovered the way to study Finnegan's Wake is in a group, and then he discovered the way to do it is reading aloud. I made the third step. The way to do it is in a group, reading aloud with a couple of six-packs of Guinness. And then you might as well be in Dublin. That's why that's up there.
Now, marijuana doesn't help reading Finnegan's Wake?
As a matter of fact, it does. As a matter of fact, marijuana helps a great deal in reading Finnegan's Wake, but Guinness has the right flavor to get you into the joy scene.
Right part of the world. I guess my last question is, what final words would you have for neurological magicians on the path?
Doubt. Doubt everything. Doubt even that you have the ability to doubt everything.
Didn't Descartes start that way?
I think Buddha said something to that effect, too, if I remember correctly.
Maybe we'll have Gabriel ask you a few questions now, if you're still willing to
go
a little bit longer.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, great.
I'm not exhausted yet.
Okay, you're back on. We're here with Gabriel now.
Hello.
Gabriel plays a major role in The Dead by Choice.
Oh, excellent.
But I won't go through that one, though.
Thank you. Well, I've not really got a prepared interview for you, kind of thinking more. But I'd like to take a break. You want us to get that?
Well, let's see if it's another goddamn salesman. Let them listen. We'll see.
Well, now we've got Robert Anton Wilson saying, goddamn salesman. We can put that in the song.
Yeah.
Just loop it on the site. Goddamn salesman. Goddamn salesman.
Like the Marion Barry record?
Yeah. First off, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. Read not all of your books, but some of them. Quantum Psychology stands in my top five books of all times. And a particular thing that I really enjoyed was your exercises that you gave on the end of each chapter. I felt like, you know, a book that's telling how to, you know, change your reality or consciousness or explaining ways of living, if it's just a book and that's where it ends, it often doesn't help a lot. You have to actually do the things that the book talks about, I think.
That's why I put the exercises in.
Figured, yeah. Precisely.
You see how much time I save with that message?
Yeah.
If I had to jump up and pick up the phone every goddamn time a salesperson called, I would eventually get a shotgun and walk down the street shooting salespeople, you know, like one of these nuts that you read about in the tabloids. I mean, they can really drive you bonkers. That just screens them all out. I don't have to jump up and answer the phone every time.
Wow.
None of them ever leave any messages on my machine.
Wow.
They figure I'm a bad sales prospect.
And you would be.
I am. I never buy anything because somebody's trying to sell it. I buy something when I think I need it or want it.
Mm. That's what they're trying to make you think, that you need it and want it.
Yeah, but I know when I need or want something.
Well, I'm glad you're not walking down the street with a shotgun. I don't live too far from here.
That was a pretty wild metaphor. I saw a movie about, a documentary about multiple killers on A&E last night about guys who go wacko and shoot up the office where they work, you know. And I was thinking, they never mentioned the fact that one of the main causes is the fact that most people are bored with their jobs and their bosses are petty tyrants and they hate every hour they spend there. They never talk about that side of it. It's what was wrong with his genes, you know.
I guess that goes into your boredom turning into fear, because boredom is the worst state. So fear, it turns into just rash anger.
Yeah.
But it's just boredom. It's just they're not being stimulated.
Yeah, well, yeah. In ordinary conditions, boredom tends to turn into anger. It's in an isolation tank, it turns into paranoia, because there's nobody to be angry at.
Yeah. So, I wrote down a list of some of the tools you mentioned that you've tried in your life.
Uh-huh.
It's a very incomplete list, but there's some particular ones that I have interest in. General semantics, linguistics, neuro-linguistic programming, and Zen. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind going into a little more depth on each of those. I'll prompt you, of course.
Well, general semantics seems tremendously important to me. When Science and Sanity came out in 1933, some of the leading scientists in the world wrote rave reviews of it about how important it was. And now, 70-plus years later, it hasn't had the impact it should have had, which I think is a major tragedy. If more people would try to apply Koshevsky's principles, the world may not become utopia overnight, but it would become a lot less crazy and bizarre than it is at present. You just have to listen to political speeches to realize here are people making noise and getting applauded for it, and they're not saying a goddamn thing that can be measured or tested or checked out or sensorily confirmed or confirmed by intuition or anything. It's just noise.
Mm-hmm.
Politics, advertising, religion, they all exploit semantic ignorance. If people had more semantic sophistication, most of the politicians, most of the religious leaders, and most of the people who write commercials would all be out of business. I think that is something I really think would do the world a lot of good.
Mm-hmm.
neurolinguistic programming is based partly on general semantics and partly on Milton Erickson's hypnotic techniques. And I found it very valuable. The gimmicks are not nearly as important as the attitude of realizing how your words are affecting people. I wrote recently, I think it's on my website, everybody who speaks to anybody else is pronouncing a blessing or a curse, whether they know it or not. Mm-hmm. Words do have tremendous impact.
Mm-hmm. Like positive affirmations.
Yeah, and negative things, negative too, have tremendous effects.
And affirmations not...
Yeah, Rossi's book, which I mentioned earlier, The Psychobiology of Mind-Body Healing, he begins with a case of a guy killed by a shaman pointing a death bone at him. Is that magic? It's documented. It really happened.
I don't know.
So the fundamentalist materialists have to say it didn't happen or it was just coincidence or something like that. I don't think it's done through supernatural means, but I do think people are very influenced by words. And when a shaman points a death bone at you, he recites a curse while he's doing it. Pardon me, I don't mean to point in your direction. I don't have a death bone anyway. But
it can be a very powerful thing.
Oh, yes.
Same with your father telling you you're stupid every day.
Oh, God, yes, or, yeah.
Any other speech or messages even that come into your mind, which brings me kind of full circle back to something I picked up out of one of your books, and I've always tried to apply English Prime. And I was wondering if you could just mention to our audience what English Prime is and how to use it in your own life.
Well, I'm getting, there I go again, you see, I am, as violating English Prime. I'm getting much better at using it in my writing. It's getting easier and easier. My speech, I still use the is of identity too damn much. I'm still working on correcting the speech.
I remember reading that in one of your books.
What?
I remember reading in one of your books that very same sentence.
Yeah, I'm still working on it.
I'm getting the writing down, but the speaking is a lot harder.
I know a PhD in psychology who claims he even thinks in E-prime now. That's one of my goals, to survive long enough to achieve that. English prime, English without is, forces you to think in what Kozubski called a scientific manner, but it's also very similar to the way they teach you to think in Buddhism, which is in terms of relations rather than in terms of essences. Like... you have a date with somebody, they don't show up. God damn them, they don't care about me at all, selfish bastards, sons of, you know, all that stuff. You don't know what the hell, maybe they got hit by a car. Maybe they got held up by an accident in an elevator. You don't know, you know. But that's an obvious example, but it gets much more subtle. Like, this is pornography, therefore we should ban it. Who the hell, what does this mean in that sense? In that sense, is means I judge it to be pornography. Now, if we could all learn to say things like that, I judge it to be pornography, I don't judge it to be pornography, it'd be obvious that we're talking about ourselves, not about the material. Mm-hmm. Like in quantum mechanics, they don't say the electron is a wave or the electron is a particle. They say the wave model works in some cases and the particle model works in some cases, and they leave out the is entirely. The effort to give up using the word is seems strenuous and clumsy at first, and it might seem pointless, but the more you work at it, the more clear your thinking gets and the less apt you are to have strong emotional reactions to things which don't require strong emotional reactions, mm-hmm. things which should be considered more calmly and judiciously. I'm not against emotional reactions, but they belong in some areas. They don't belong in the area of politics. One of my wife's great sayings was, this is changing the subject slightly, but charisma is so powerful that the only safe place for it is in show business. Once it gets loose in politics or religion, all hell breaks loose.
That's a very wise thing.
I think so. She was a very wise woman.
So, kind of steer you back again. English Prime. In regards to using, say, seems to be or judge it to be rather than is, do you think that it definitely limits the emotional impact of negative statements coming from us or towards us, assuming that they're translated into English Prime, because then they're more about the person speaking rather than an actuality in the Platonic universe. But in relation to, say, Christian Science or in positive self-talk, Is it better? Does it seem to you to be better to use English prime or the stronger is, for example, during devotional prayer or something like that?
It depends on the circumstances. I will violate my own principles when I think it's necessary to do so to cheer somebody up, which includes trying to implant positive suggestions in people with illnesses. Mm-hmm. Neurolinguistic programming, they distinguish between the meta model, and the meta model can be identified with English prime. No is, no objectification. Everything has a report of an observer, just like quantum mechanics or Zen Buddhism. It's how the observer reacts to how the observer observes, re-interact with each other. And the Milton model, which is based on Milton Erickson's hypnotic techniques, in which you can violate all the rules of the meta model as long as you're doing it benevolently.
Yeah. How about Zen? You mentioned that you've tried Zen.
Yeah.
What did you try?
Well, I read a few books on Zen back in the 50s. In 1962, I was lucky enough to be living in Yellow Springs while Yoshitani Hiroshi was living in a bomb shelter, which a bunch of Quakers had donated to him. He had two assistant monks and was giving Zen meditation sessions and practices and so on. I studied with Yoshitani for a while. And I still have a great fascination with Zen, but I don't do Zen meditation at all because I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, it just doesn't suit me. I prefer transcendental meditation, and without paying them a huge fee to get a mantra tailored just to me, I've decided any goddamn mantra you pick works just about as well as any other if you stick to it. My favorite mantra I will now reveal, Shamadi Shawadi Shamadi Shawadi Shamadi 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 Shawadi Shamadi Shawadi Shamadi Shawadi Shamadi 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 Shawadi. Doesn't mean a damn thing in Hindu or any other language, but it acts very much like a windshield wiper in banishing wandering thoughts and getting you concentrated.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the difference is between transcendental meditation and Zen meditation?
Transcendental meditation costs a lot more, but if you don't want to pay their fees, it's easier to do. And I find it much more congenial than counting my breaths 1 to 10. I always get to 14 at some point, realize I screwed up. the mantra, it's much easier to just keep the mantra going. It is much easier. It seems much easier to me.
It seems much easier to you, sir. So have you ever tried, say, instead of breathing, just no thought at all? No mantra, no thought, no...
Oh, yeah.
And that one seems much more difficult.
Well, sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's quite hard. It depends depends on how much uphill work you got to do. Mm-hmm. I've spent a lot of time investigating my mind brainwave machines, which are supposed to put you down in theta or delta very quickly.
Right.
They seem to work pretty damn well. Mm-hmm. And the trouble is, when I started writing about them, everybody started sending me their own machines, and I couldn't tell anymore what was the long-range effect of the machine I used last week and what was the new effect of the machine I was trying this week. But by and large, I think there are some quacks in that field. By and large, I think those brainwave machines can help a lot for people who don't know how to get started on meditation. Mm-hmm. And even those who have some practice, it helps to keep you in trim if you've gotten out of practice for a while.
Hmm. Yeah, I was kind of just thinking about the possibility of having one of those as a crutch almost, where you can't quite anchor that sort of a state of calmness without hooking little electrodes to your head or listening to a tape first.
Well, there's a guy called Tom Kenyon who puts out tapes which combine neurolinguistic programming with rhythms that work their way down from beta to alpha to theta to delta. And if you can stay awake by the time you get to delta, the neurolinguistic programming techniques really have a tremendous effect. I think there's a great area there for future research. We're going to learn a lot more about that.
To switch over to a whole nother gear, I want to go all the way back to the beginning of Jordan's interview with you and talk a little more about optimism, because I think that is, that's a very important practice in the everyday life. I mean, you mentioned, you know, kind of the basic rational, I think, way of looking at it. You can be unhappy or you can be happy. There you go. You're going to be one or the other if you choose it. So which one would you rather be? And I think most people would say optimistic. But I was kind of wondering if you have any little techniques that you use when there's small hardships of life. You know, a salesman calls three times in a row and, oops, you picked it up this time. I mean, how do you have any, do you breathe? Do you laugh out loud just for the heck of it? Do you try to do anything to come back into optimism?
Optimism has become a habit with me. As far as negative feelings towards other people, I still have some problems with that, but I get out of it by suddenly when I realize I've built up a strong negative attitude, I just short-circuit it by thinking, what am I doing this to myself for? I'm not doing them any harm. I'm just stewing and making myself sick and maybe giving myself ulcers. And besides, I don't know all the facts. How can I judge? I mean, basically it's rational therapy. Basically, it's Albert Ellis I use more than anything else when I'm having negative feelings. Doesn't matter what technique you use. The main thing is to get rid of negative feelings. Because the more negative feelings you're carrying around about the more people you got negative feelings about, the bigger the load gets, the more it's going to crush you. Meanwhile, most of them don't even know you're busy sulking over them anyway.
Good point. I just wanted to make a connection. I've heard a lot, certainly, about language, English prime, removing is and replacing it with maybe seems to be, maybe all for, I think you coined the word some but all.
Yeah.
Some but not all. I want to just briefly touch on also labeling theory, which I think I've read in one of your books before, but kind of as a connection between not only passing negative energy or labeling, giving people, you know, I guess labels, I don't know how else to say it at the moment, but telling them that they are something and limiting them to that thing, which then they can't get out of unless they, you know, label you as a liar or wrong, just downward.
Yeah, that represents one of the strongest contributions in general strength. Once you get rid of the years of identity, you can't identify a person with a label.
Right.
And I think identifying people with labels probably represents the major cause of human negativity in general. Yeah. People put nasty labels on people they get angry at. People carry around nasty labels about themselves that their parents told them when they were 4 years old and they don't know, they're still reacting to it. And
do you feel that it's possible?
The best cure for bad labels is to remember the map is not the territory. And the map does not show all the territory. And besides, you're not a worried anyway. So whatever anybody calls you. A couple of my books, I insisted on putting negative reviews on the jacket as well as positive reviews. I had a variety of reasons for that. One was to show the negative reviewers, I don't give a damn what you think about me. A childish little thing. Another was because I just felt that there are people who are trying to promote me into being some sort of a guru or something of the sort, and I want to discourage them by showing them that not everybody takes me seriously. Some people think I'm a first-class asshole, and they ought to remember that.
Yeah, I'm sure you have many labels around the world.
Yeah.
Does it seem to you that it's possible to experience life without a self-label?
Yes.
Really? Wow. What do you think that would be like?
I stopped labeling myself quite a while ago.
So is it an active thing? I mean, deep down, you still eat food, and I mean, doesn't that inspire a label if I'm a biological creature at least?
While I'm eating food, I'm acting like a biological creature. When I'm doing other things, I'm acting like an artistic creature. When I'm doing other things, I'm acting like a damn fool.
What are you?
Hmm?
What are you? I wanted to go back because Jordan didn't answer the riddle. Who is the master that makes the grass green? And I'll pose the riddle to you. And how would you answer that, Zen Koan?
I haven't the foggiest idea how to answer it for a Roshi to satisfy a Roshi, but I feel quite secure that I know the answer. And to screw up on the Zen, and the answer is you make the grass green. Galileo rediscovered that fact about 300 years ago, but it still hasn't sunk in. Of course, when I say you do it, that doesn't mean you do it all by yourself. There's got to be grass there. There's got to be something green there. You wouldn't see green. But the green is not in the thing, and the green is not in you. The green is in the transaction between you and the external event. And that's Thinkso Zen, as they would say in Japan.
It reminds me, you were a transactional psychologist, correct?
Hmm?
Were you a transactional psychologist at some point in your life?
Well, not exactly, but I have read a lot of people, writers of that school, and I once attended a workshop in which all the Ames perception demonstrations were shown, and that's almost as good as LSD as far as making you realize how much your nervous system is creating of what you think of as external reality. You know, one of the demonstrations seems to be a window turning around, a window frame turning around, then they stick a bar in, and the window frame keeps turning around and goes right through the bar, huh? You know, and they got dozens of demonstrations like that. There's the cockeyed room, two guys come in, it's usually two guys, at least when I saw it was, and they walk to opposite ends of the room, one shrinks to a dwarf and the other enlarges to a giant. And yeah, there's a couple of dozen of those demonstrations. Then you really know the master who makes the grass green after you've been through that.
Well, how about for young aspiring, going back again to the young aspiring individual, who may be of any age but is young and aspiring, what do you suggest? You suggested earlier that they get into maybe general semantics, linguistics, NLP, kind of stay away from the occult or Western mysticism for now. Could you give them any practices, any simple exercises they can do in the morning, in the evening, anytime?
Well, try forgiving everybody that you pissed off and try abolishing the is from your language as much as possible, at least when you're writing, and then try practice it. Try to get it out of your conversation, too. And keep reading books on consciousness and evolution to find clues to lead you wherever your path will be most, the path for you will be found. There are different paths for different people. Why are there so many schools of Buddhism? It's not because people like to form schools, but then the message is for everybody, but different people have to receive it through different funnels. Arlen and I were married in a Shinran Buddhist temple. I like Shinran Buddhism because it's the world's kindest religion. It's a branch of Amida Buddhism. Amida was the Buddha of boundless compassion who refused to enter nirvana until all sentient beings could enter with him. So the teaching arose that if you called on him in Japanese, the name is Namu Amida Butsu, in the name of Amida Buddha. With true faith, you will eventually, no matter how many incarnations it takes, you'll eventually get rid of all the negativity and become pure enlightenment. And Shinran was a reformer who said, that's asking too much of people. Some people are just not capable of true faith. They have a constantly skeptical and questioning mind. They should not be banned from release. So he taught that if you say Namu Amida Butsu, whether you believe in it or not, it will work. I like that. That's my idea of a religion that doesn't give anybody a bum trip. Most religions seem to be concentrating on putting people on bum trips, you know. That's the only religion in the world I know that never puts you on a bum trip. If you've said it just once, and I've said it three times, I think, in the last, Namu Amida Butsu, guaranteed. He's like a finance company in reverse. He wants to give you something for nothing. How can you reject a short-term interim savior like that? His only real competition is J.R. Bob Dobbs.
I guess I'm just wondering when you started writing.
Oh, God, that's so far back I can't even remember. Before I got out of grammar school, I was doing cartoon books. Then I discovered there were books without pictures in them. And I figured, hell, it's much easier to just do the words and don't have to do the pictures, too. I was writing all through my high school years. I got published in the high school literary journal. Ha, anybody can do that, you know. I sold my first two articles on my 26th birthday. That was a very happy birthday.
When did you know, when was there a point in your life that you felt writing would be the key part in your path?
I always wanted it to be, but I didn't have anybody to encourage me for a long time. My parents told me, you got to get a job, you got to be reasonable, you try to be a writer, you'll probably starve to death, et cetera, et cetera. But I kept on, I got a job and I wrote in my spare time.
Would you consider writing an activity that connects you to a higher source of your being?
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the ones where I'll give you a definite yes or no. Every writer has a different name for it. Homer called it the muse. Faulkner called it the daemon, which is Greek. It's not quite the same as the Christian demon. It's not evil. It's just your higher self. Mailer calls it the navigator in the unconscious, whatever you want to call it. When the writing is going good, you're not doing it. Something you're channeling. And I'm not going to speculate about what you're channeling, but you're channeling.
What are your feelings about death? Do you have a philosophy or a spirituality based on... Is there another life for you?
I don't know. Somebody asked the Zen master, what happens after death? And he replied, I don't know. And they said, but you're a Zen master. He said, but I'm not a dead Zen master. And I figure there are five alternatives. Oblivion. How the hell can that scare anybody? If you're oblivious, by definition, you don't know it. So what's frightening about something you can't experience? Absorption into the Godhead. That sounds like even better than acid. So I have nothing to fear there. Reincarnation. That's not so bad. If I come back as a cockroach, I can jump around on the keys of somebody's computer and write poetry like Archie did for Don Mahito, Don Marquis. Ever read any of the Archie poems?
No. Well,
oh, Archie was a cockroach who used to jump around the keys of Don's typewriter while he was out of the office at night. And there are three books of Archie's poems.
So a cockroach has its purpose, too.
Oh, yeah, at least Archie did. Or I might come back as a human being and meet Arlen again and marry her again. That's a wonderful thought. Then there's hell. Now, the climate is said to be dreadful, but the company is it's the best minds of human history. Everybody's in hell, you know, everybody worth knowing. So you got a dreadful climate, but great philosophical inspiration and fascinating people to talk to. And then there's heaven. That one really scares me. I hear it's full of Christians, and some of them even claim nobody gets in but Christians. And there's even more sinister report that the streets are guarded by the United States Marines. An all-Christian place with Marines on every street corner, it sounds like the worst totalitarian state I can imagine. So heaven is the only thing that scares me. But fortunately, I have no chance of going there because I'm not a Christian. And the other alternative, you see, they all have a bright side to them. So the only thing I'm really afraid of is heaven, and I can't go there.
How much more to ask?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're quite welcome.